I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Thomas Jones, host of the LRB podcast, and before we begin today's episode, I'd like to tell you about Bluettes, a play opening next month at the Royal Court Theatre in London, starring Ben Whishaw, Emma Darcy, and Kayla Michael. Based on Maggie Nelson's book, Bluettes is a meditation on love and grief, a story about depression and desire, pleasure and pain, and a person obsessed with the colour blue. It's adapted for the stage by Margaret Perry and directed by Katie Mitchell. And it runs at the Royal Court from the 17th of May to the 29th of June. Click on the link in the description to book tickets. You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. This week we have Terry Eagleton's LRB Winter Lecture, delivered, despite his having a chest infection, at St James's Church, Clerkenwell, on the 27th of March, 2024, on the question of where does culture come from, and there'll be an audience Q&A at the end.
Thank you. Yes, I'm not in the best of health, I'm afraid. But nevertheless, dauntless, I rose from my sick bed in Ireland and crossed the sea in order to be with you this evening. And I put it like that so as to extract the maximum amount of pathos from the situation. I don't want any applause. I just want you to be quietly appreciative of my courage and resoluteness, and also not to ask me any hard questions in the discussion, because I don't like hard questions, and my doctors say that I'm not to take any. In fact, they say it might bring on a fit of a paroxysm of coughing and so on. So if you just go easy on me, I'd be very glad. In Thomas Hardy's novel, Jude the Obscure, Jude Fawley finds himself living in the area of Oxford, still known today as Jericho, home at the time to a bunch of craftsmen and artisans who maintained the fabric of the university, and home these days to a bunch of students and young professionals who listen to Central Cee and eat a lot of muesli. I mentioned Central Cee just to show you that I'm not just a grey-haired academic, but I am a real human being, and I want you to just keep that steadily in mind throughout what I have to say. It doesn't take Jude long to realize that he and his fellow craftsmen are, so to speak, the material base to the intellectual superstructure of the colleges, that without their labor, the colleges couldn't exist as they do. That without their work, as Jude says, the hard readers could not read, nor the high thinkers live. He comes to recognize, in a word, that the origin of culture is labor. Now that lands me with a bit of a problem, because I'm only about a minute into this lecture, and I've already answered the question that I pose in my title. So I'm not exactly sure what I should do. I can sing some very fine Irish love songs, actually. I'd better just improvise desperately from now on, if you just bear with me. The origin of culture is labour. This is true etymologically as well, because one of the original meanings of the word culture is the tending of natural growth, is agriculture. And a cognate word, culture, means the blade of a plough. And the kinship between culture and agriculture was brought home to me some years ago when I was driving with the Dean of Arts of a state university in the United States, and we passed farms blooming with luxuriant crops. Might get a couple of professorships out of that, the Dean said. Might get a couple of professorships out of those farms blooming with crops, a state university. Now, this, to be sure, isn't the way culture itself generally likes to see itself. Like the Oedipal child, it tends to disown its lonely or lowly parentage and fantasize instead that it sprang from its own loins, self-generating and self-fashioning. Thought for idealist philosophers is self-dependent. You can't nip behind it to something more fundamental, since that itself would have to be captured in a thought. Geist goes all the way down. But there's an irony here, I think, because few things bind art more closely to its material surroundings than its claim to stand free of them, its claim to be autonomous. And that's because the work of art as autonomous and self-determining, which is an idea that goes back really only to the late 18th century, serves as a model of a version of human beings, a version of the human subject, that has been rapidly gaining ground in actual life. Men and women are now seen increasingly as authors of themselves, with the deepening influence of liberalism and possessive individualism, and, to perpetrate a dreadful cliché, the rise of the middle classes. If you open a history book at random, it will say three things about the period that you alight on. It will say, first of all, it was a period of rapid change. Secondly, it was essentially a transitional period. And thirdly, the middle classes went on rising. That's why God put the middle classes on earth, you know, so they could keep steadily rising, a bit like the sun, but not setting. You can't have culture in the sense of galleries and museums and publishing houses unless society has evolved to the point where it can produce an economic surplus. Only then can some people be released from the business of providing for the physical survival of the tribe in order to constitute a permanent caste of priests, bards, DJs, hermeneuticists, bassoon players, LRB interns. Do I hear an LRB intern? Gaffers on film sets, and all the rest of it. In fact, you might, a bit riskily maybe, you might define culture as a surplus over strict need. We need to eat, but we don't need to eat at the Ivy. We need to wear clothes in cold climates anyway, but they don't need to be designed by Stella McCartney. The problem with that definition of culture, however, is that a capacity for surplus is built into the kinds of natural material creatures that we are. For both good and ill, we're continually in excess of ourselves, for both good and ill. Culture is reckoned into our nature. There's a lot about this in King Lear. Because the material production which gives rise to an economic surplus, gives rise to culture, is racked by conflict, bits of this culture tend to be used from time to time to legitimate the social order which strives to contain or resolve those conflicts, and this is known as ideology. That, I think, is one difference between the notion of culture and the notion of ideology. The notion of culture is wider than ideology. I mean, not all culture is ideological, serves that function at any given time, But any piece of it, however abstract or high-minded, can serve that function in particular circumstances. On the other hand, we shouldn't forget that culture can muster some vigorous resistance to the dominant powers. And that happens curiously the more art becomes just another commodity on the marketplace, the artist just another petty commodity producer. Before that, in traditional or pre-modern society, culture generally serves as an instrument of political sovereignty, which means, among other things, that there are steady jobs for cultural workers, as court poets, genealogists, licensed fools, painters patronised by the landed gentry, composers in the pay of princes, and so on. You also know more or less who you're writing or painting or composing for, whereas the marketplace strikes your audience anonymous. So, the world now no longer owes the cultural worker a living. Ironically, however, it's the integration of art into the market which allows it a degree of freedom, because once art becomes primarily a commodity, it becomes autonomous, which is to say, autonomous of its traditional social functions. Deprived of those ends, it may curve back upon itself, taking itself as its own subject matter, as its own raison d'être, as in a lot of modernism, but it's also free, if it likes, to become critique for the first time historically on any major scale. The miseries of commodification, in other words, are also an enthralling moment of emancipation. History, as Marx reminds us, moves by its bad side, progresses by its bad side. In the very process of being pushed to the margin, the artist begins to claim visionary, prophetic, bohemian, subversive status, partly because those on the edges indeed can sometimes see more than those in the middle, but also to compensate for a loss of centrality. A movement called Romanticism is born. You'll notice that this is a quick cultural history, more or less from the Stone Age onwards, which cuts the occasional corner every now and then, but I hope you'll forgive that. I'll get on to postmodernism later. A movement called Romanticism is born, and so, roughly at the same time, is industrial capitalism, which with admirable convenience gives culture a job of work to do just at the time when it's in danger of being driven out by a lot of Philistine mill owners. There's now a growing divide between the symbolic realm and the world of utility, a divide which runs all the way down the human body. Values are energies for which there's no, isn't much call in the workaday world of bodily labour, are siphoned off increasingly into a sphere of their own, one which consists of three major sectors. First of all, by far the most important, religion, then sexuality, and then art. And one of these endangered values that has to be siphoned off and cultivated somewhere else is the so-called creative imagination, which becomes enormously popular. You know, this rather modest faculty of the imagination is inflated by literary types everywhere, you know, into some transcendent capability. The creative imagination, in the sense in which we know it, was invented in the late 18th century. And it's nowadays, as I say, everywhere revered among artistic types, even though organising genocide in Gaza requires a lot of creative imagination. There's nothing intrinsically valuable about it. So the distance which opens between the symbolic and the utilitarian, while threatening to rob culture of much of its social function, to be sure, is also the operative distance which you need for critique. And much of what I'm saying also applies to the university. That also opens an operative distance between itself and the rest of society, scorned sometimes as the ivory tower and so on, but also one of the enabling conditions of critique. Culture would, so the idea went, culture would expose the crippled, diminished nature of industrial capitalist humanity, not by what it said, but by its own free, full, all-round expression of human powers and capacities, a theme which runs all the way from Schiller and Ruskin to William Morris and Herbert Marcuse. Art and culture can now become a powerful rebuke to society, not so much, as I say, by virtue of what it says or states or shows, but simply because of the strange, pointless, intensely libidinal thing that it is. It's one of the few remaining activities in an increasingly instrumentalized world, which exists purely for its own sake. One of the other members of that extremely small and privileged category is God. God exists purely for his own sake, but also potentially human beings. The point of political change on this view is to make that condition increasingly available to as many men and women as possible, so that they too could live for the pure delight of it, or to use a technical theological term, for the pure hell of it. Where art was, there shall humanity be, that romantic humanist promise. The harmonious realization of one's powers as an end in itself, well, if that's what the aesthetic by this time comes to be about, it's also what the ethics of romantic humanism is about, which for this purpose includes Karl Marx. The aesthetic, I think, only ever becomes important when it speaks of more than itself, when it's not simply about itself, but becomes somehow allegorical or symbolic of wider issues. And that's just what's happening here. Marx's thought concerns the material conditions which would make life for its own sake possible for whole societies, among which he ranks very importantly the shortening of the working day. Marxism, in other words, is about leisure, not about labour. The only good reason for being a socialist, apart from annoying people that you don't like very much, is that you don't like working. And there are a lot of people like that. It's a wonder they're not all socialists. In fact, for Oscar Wilde, who is closer in this respect to Marx than he is to William Morris, communism was the condition in which we would simply lie around all day in various interesting postures of jouissance, dressed in loose crimson garments, reciting Homer to each other and sipping absinthe. And that would just be the working day. There are problems with this vision, as there are with any ethics. The full, all-round, harmonious, symmetrical, etc., realization of human powers, does that mean that all of your powers are to be realized just because you have a capacity? Does that mean realizing it? Some people think so. D.H. Lawrence, for example, thought that. What about that obsessive desire to beat up Tony Blair? You know, does that really demand spontaneous realization? Or should one realize only those impulses which spring from the authentic core of the self? That's another theory. But by what criteria does one measure that? What if my self-realization clashes with yours? Enormous problem. Traditional problem of liberal society. And why should all-round expression beat devoting oneself to a single cause, like Alexei Navalny or Emma Raducanu? Also, another big problem, do human capacities become malevolent only by virtue of being alienated, lopsided, or repressed? Are they otherwise okay in themselves? And what if, final problem, what if we're half in love with the powers which alienate and repress us, installed as they are on the inside of the human subject rather than purely external to it. Well, Hegel and Marx have, which is always an excellent way to begin a sentence, Hegel and Marx have an answer of a kind to this problem, certainly to the problem of clashing self-fulfillments, which goes like this. Realize only those capabilities which allow others to do the same. Reciprocal self-realization, to which Marx gives the name of communism. Or, as the Communist Manifesto puts it, the free development of each as the condition of the free development of all. When the fulfillment of one individual is the ground and condition of the fulfillment of another, and vice versa, we call that love. Marxism is about political love. It's just that somebody forgot to mention this to Stalin. I mean, of course, love in its real sense. I mean, you know, caritas, agape, not the sexual, erotic, romantic varieties of it, which late capitalist society makes such a fetish all the time. We're speaking of the kind of love that can be deeply disagreeable, that you'd rather not have, and that has nothing necessarily to do with feeling. Love that's a social practice rather than a sentiment, and that's in danger of getting you killed. Now, early industrial capitalism had another mission for culture to accomplish. A new actor had just appeared on the political scene, the industrial working class, and was threatening to be obstreperous. And culture, in the sense of the refined and civilized, was thus needed to buy off the other half of Matthew Arnold's celebrated title, anarchy. Unless liberal values were disseminated to the masses, they might end up sabotaging those values, liberal culture altogether. What had traditionally fulfilled that task? Religion. In breeding a sense of duty, reverence, deference, obligation, altruism, spiritual edification and so on, religion had performed that task pretty well. But religious belief was now on the wane as the industrial bourgeoisie demythologized social existence by its secularizing activities, which ironically ended up depleting what had been a precious ideological resource, namely religion. Culture then had to take over from the churches as artists transubstantiated the profane stuff of everyday life into eternal truth. And that project was utterly unsuccessful, which is another story. What else was happening around the time of Romanticism and industrial capitalism? The revolution in France. One might do worse than claim that it was this which thrust culture to the fore in the modern age, but I mean culture as a riposte to the revolution, culture as an antidote to political turbulence. Politics involves decision, calculation, practical rationality, the time of the present, whereas culture can be thought of as belonging to a different dimension altogether, one in which customs and pieties evolve spontaneously, unconsciously, sometimes with almost glacial slowness. And culture may therefore be seen simply as an idea, irrespective of its particular artifacts, as resistant to the notion of throwing up barricades, resistant to the notion, in a certain sense, of political activity as such, which in that light appears more mechanistic and superficial and short-term. And the name for that contrast in Britain is Edmund Burke, who hailed from a nation in which the sovereign power had failed to root itself in the affections of the people because it was a colonialist power. And in Burke's view, this rooting isn't happening either in revolutionary France, since the Jacobins and their successors don't understand that if the law is to be feared, it's also to be loved. So what you need, in Burke's opinion, is a law which, though male, of course, will deck itself out in the alluring garments, female garments, of culture. All this is in Burke's early essay called On the Origin of Ideas of the Beautiful and the Sublime, not in the French Revolution book. Power must beguile and seduce if it isn't to drive us into Oedipal revolt. The potentially terrifying sublimity of the masculine must be tempered and softened by the beauty of the feminine, those two key 18th century aesthetic terms, sublime, the sublime and the beautiful. And this aestheticizing of power is for Burke exactly what the French revolutionaries have calamitously failed to achieve. You mustn't, to be sure, aestheticize power away altogether. The ugly bulge of the law's phallus must be visible from time to time through its diaphanous female garments, so that citizens may be suitably cowed and intimidated when they need to be. Burke is absolutely not against a bit of, you know, cowing and intimidating. But even so, the law can't work by terror alone. And Burke sees this, of course, not just in France, but in his own native Ireland and in India. The law can't work by terror alone, which is why it must become a cross-dresser. And that's the only bit of this lecture you'll remember in 2 weeks' time. So Burke believes that the cultural domain, the domain of sentiment, habit, piety, custom, prejudice, and so on, is more fundamental than the political domain to which he dedicated his life. And surely, in one sense, at least, he's right to do so. I mean, there have been some rather suspect, and still are, ways of elevating the cultural over the political. But Burke, who begins his career as an aesthetician, neither despises politics from the Olympian standpoint of high culture, nor dissolves politics into cultural affairs. Instead, he recognizes that culture in the anthropological sense, culture as a way of life and so on, is the place where power has to bed itself down if it is to take hold, if it is to be effective. Culture, in that sense, is absolutely vital for the sustaining and reproducing of power. If the political doesn't find a home in the cultural, it won't work, and its sovereignty will collapse. And one doesn't have to detest the Jacobins or idealise Marie Antoinette in order to take the point of that. Despite his aversion to Jacobinism, Burke ended up feeling some sympathy for the revolutionary United Irish movement, which sought to drive the British out of Ireland, an extraordinary sentiment, if you think about it, for a British Member of Parliament. The Irish playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan, also an MP, was even more dedicated to the United Irish cause, was in fact a secret fellow traveller with it, a fact which, had it been widely known, might have wiped the smiles off the faces of his London theatre audiences. The United Irishmen were Enlightenment anti-colonialists, not romantic nationalists, but the rise of romantic nationalism in the early 19th century once more brings culture to the centre of political life. Nationalism was to prove the most successful revolutionary movement of the modern age, toppling despots and dismantling empires, and culture in both its artistic and anthropological senses was to prove vital in this project. With revolutionary nationalism, culture in the sense of language, custom, tradition, history, religion, ethnicity becomes what people are prepared to kill for or prepared to die for. I mean, not many people are prepared to kill for Balzac or David Bowie, But culture in that more specialist sense also plays a key role in nationalist politics. And there are jobs for artists once more, jobs for cultural workers. As from Yeats and MacDiarmid to Sibelius and Senghor, they become public figures and political activists. They've found something to belong to. Absolutely key historical movement. In fact, nationalism has been described as the most poetic of all forms of politics. When the British shot some Irish nationalists in 1916 in Dublin, a British army officer is said to have remarked to an Irish citizen, "We have done your country some service. We have rid it of some second-rate poets." Quite a few of the revolutions were poets. Actually, second-rate is rather charitable, given some of their works. The nation itself resembles a work of art, being autonomous, unified, self-determining, self-originating. And as that kind of language may suggest, both art and the nation are beginning to rank among the many surrogates for the almighty that the modern age has come up with. Because that language, like most aesthetic language, is secretly theological. Aesthetic culture is like religion in all kinds of ways, of course, and it's in its communal rites, in its priesthood of artists, its sense of the numinous, its search for transcendence. And if it fails to replace religion, as it signally does, it's among other things because culture in the artistic sense simply involves too few people, while culture in the sense of a distinctive way of life involves too much conflict. The fact is, however, that no symbolic system in history has been able to rival religious faith, which forges a bond between the routine behaviour of billions of people and the most ultimate imperishable truths. It's the most enduring, deep-seated, universal form of popular culture that history has ever witnessed, and I bet you won't find it on a single cultural studies course from Sydney to San Diego. The doctor warned me about this. For the liberal humanist heritage, culture matters because it represented, or mattered, because it represented certain fundamental universal values which might constitute a common ground between those who were otherwise divided. It was a ground on which we could converge, anybody could converge simply, an astonishingly revolutionary idea, simply by virtue of our shared humanity, not because you were the son of a viscount or whatever, yes? And in that sense, it was an enlightened notion. But since our shared humanity is a somewhat abstract concept, you needed something to bring this home to experience, something you could see and touch and weigh in your hand, and that was known as art or literature. If somebody asked you what you ultimately lived by, you gave them not a religious sermon or a political pamphlet, you gave them a volume of Shakespeare, especially if they were your colonials. And the self-interest of that project, as with almost all appeals to unity of any kind, the self-interest is obvious enough. Culture, as with the bourgeois state for Marx, represents an abstract community and equality which compensates for actual inequities and antagonisms. In the presence of the essential and universal, we are invited to suspend our superficial distinctions of class and gender and ethnicity and the like. Even so, this liberal humanist vision captures a truth, I think, in however self-serving a form, that what human beings have in common is in the end more important than what than their differences. It's just that politically speaking, the end is a long time coming. This vision of culture as deep common ground was challenged by a whole series of developments, certainly from the 1960s onwards, the entry into higher education, to name one of many factors, of people from a background which meant they were disinclined to sign on for that consensus. the concept of culture began to lose its innocence. It had already been compromised by its association with racist ideology and imperialist anthropology in the 19th century, as well as being contaminated by political strife in the context of revolutionary nationalism. From the end of the 19th century onwards, culture became a highly lucrative industry as cultural production was integrated into production in general, and the manufacture of fantasy, mass fantasy, became a deeply profitable pursuit. This, we might note, isn't yet really postmodernism. Postmodernism happens not just with the arrival of mass culture, but with the aestheticizing of social existence as a whole. From design and advertising to branding, politics as spectacle, tattoos, purple hair, ridiculously large glasses, and so on. Culture, once the very antithesis of material production, has now been folded into production in general. Modernism, now a century behind us, was the last time that culture offered itself as a full-blooded critique of society, one launched mainly from the political, the radical right, not from the left. If it does so no longer, neither does culture in the sense of a specific form of life. Most such life forms today are not out to question the framework of modern civilization, but, magic word, to be included within them. Inclusion, however, isn't a good in itself, any more than diversity is a good in itself. One thinks fondly of Sam Gilwin's cry, "Include me out." All of that is sometimes known as cultural politics and has given rise in our own time, of course, to so-called culture wars. And that's very strange because, for Schiller and Arnold, Coleridge, the phrase culture wars would have been an oxymoron, like, say, business ethics. Samuel Beckett once remarked that he has a strong weakness for an oxymoron. The opposite of an oxymoron, I suppose, is a tautology, isn't it? For example, Scientology, which means the knowledge of knowledge. Yes? Somebody should tell Tom Cruise that sometime. Or what about internet? I think internet may be a tautology. Any nets that aren't inter? But anyway, I'd love to give a lecture on oxymorons and tautologies, but some other time. The point is, for people like Coleridge and Schiller and Ruskin and so on, culture was the solution to strife, not an example of it. Now, however, culture is no longer a way of transcending the political or dissolving it, but the very language in which certain key political demands are framed and articulated. And that really is a strikingly original development. Far from being a spiritual solution, it's become part of the problem. And we have shifted in the process from culture, singular, to cultures, plural. I'll just cut out some rather boring stuff here and move rapidly on. In our own time, culture has become nothing less than a full-blown ideology known as culturalism, yes, along with biologism, moralism, historicism, economism. Culturalism is one of the great intellectual reductions, forms of reductionism of the day. On this theory, culture goes all the way down. The nature of humanity is culture. And behind that doctrine lurks a very curious aversion to nature, which is one of culture's traditional antitheses, not the only one, but one, as obdurate, as brutally given, as inflexible, as resistant to change, and so on. To call grieving over the death of a loved one natural is for a culturalist to insinuate that such activity is or should be universal, at precisely the point where nature is capricious, unpredictable, alarmingly fast-moving, disintegrating before our eyes, culturalism insists on regarding it as inert and immobile. It's not, I think, that culture is our nature, but that culture is of our nature. It's both, culture is both possible and necessary because of the kinds of bodies we have. It's necessary because there's a gap in our nature which culture, in the sense of physical care, must move into quickly if we're to survive as infants. Yeah? Infants absolutely need culture because of a whacking great hole in our nature which demands it. Culture is possible because our bodies, unlike those of snails or spiders, are able to extend themselves outwards both by the power of labour and by the power of conceptual thought or language. And this prosthesis to our bodies, this ability to keep extending them further and further, is known as civilization. The only problem, as ancient Greek tragedy was aware, is that we can extend ourselves too far. We can lose contact with our sensuous, instinctual being, overreach ourselves, and bring ourselves to nothing. But that's another story. Since we have a couple of minutes in hand, I'll sing you an Irish love song. On Raglan Road, on an autumn day, when I first saw her, I knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I would one day rue. I saw the danger, but I strode along the enchanted way, and I said, let grief be a fallen leaf as a dawning of the day. On Grafton Street in November, we tripped lightly along the ledge of that deep ravine where can be seen the warmth of passion's pledge. The Queen of Hearts still making tarts, but I not making hay. Oh, I love too much, and by such, was happiness thrown away. I gave her gifts of the mind, I gave her the secret sign that's known to the artists who have known great gods of sound and stone. Of words and tint, I did not stint. I gave her poems to say, with her own name there and her own dark hair, like clouds over fields of May. In a lonely street where old ghosts meet, I see her walking now, away from me quite hurriedly. My reason must avow that I have loved not as I should, a creature made of clay. When the angel woos the clay, he'll lose his wings at the dawn of day.
Thank you so much, Terry. We have some time for questions or more songs, depending on how many or few questions there are. We only have one mic, so what I think we'll do is take questions from this level, and then if there's anyone in the balcony who wants to ask questions, we'll do them all in one go, and Pete, who's kindly carrying the mic, will do a very, very quick run around the balcony to get those questions. But let's start on this level. I think I saw a hand up in the aisle there.
If the BBC were to be abolished tomorrow, would it matter?
Question time.
Well, why wouldn't it matter? He said, deftly turning the question back. I think it would. I think it would matter. For one thing, we would lose an example of a non-primary, commercially driven media organisation, which is very, very valuable, I think, yeah, and which could be a model of other such organisations. So, yes, I think so. I think so.
There's a question there in the second row.
Hi, thank you. I was very interested in how you tied the autonomy of the aesthetic sphere in the 18th and 19th century with the autonomy of the nation state and the individual as well in ethical philosophy. And I was wondering, in the postmodern paradigm, what do you think has happened to the notion of autonomy?
Yeah, well, I think there isn't. Our notion of autonomy depends, doesn't it, on having a pretty full-blooded idea of the human subject, and that has faded a great deal. That's to say, the idea of the human subject as agent, yes, is key to that. And happens, this idea emerges at a time when the European middle classes are indeed carving out their own history for themselves, in isolation from, as it were, the Ancien Régime. That postmodernism belongs to a much later stage of capitalist society in which there seems to be no need for that strenuous amount of agency. And autonomy, I think, equally fades. It's interesting to ask what's the opposite of autonomy, isn't it? There's nothing wrong with the great middle-class idea of autonomy. In fact, in its own day, it's a banner of liberty, you know, to get out from under whatever it is that's determining your existence from the outside. But in the process of doing so, it tends to lose the sense that whatever autonomy we can negotiate for ourselves is based on a deeper dependency. Yeah. That there is a very fundamental dependency which sets the limits and conditions for our autonomy, which is still genuine, yeah, but there's something which always precedes autonomy. To be in place, lots of things have to have happened for autonomy to work in that way.
There's a couple of questions in that aisle. Let's take those two questions together. If you ask your question first, and then we'll take the one behind immediately after, and then Terry can answer those together.
What had struck me in what you'd mentioned was two things that live for themselves. Was one, culture, but the other one, God. I wonder how may you distinguish those two concepts?
Culture and God. Well, you don't pray to culture, at least. At least most people don't pray to culture. There is, I think culture is very much, as I tried to say, in some of its meanings, a displaced version of the deity, you know. Because if you take an idealist view of culture, a non-materialist view, then its origins are mysterious. God is the creature, is not the creature, the being, although even the word being is not quite right, that has his ends, purposes, means, grounds purely in himself, yes, which is to say, traditionally, theologically, God is the only necessary being. You know, the striking thing about everything else, not least people, is that they are necessary. Yes, they are radically contingent. Well, I don't feel this about myself, actually, but I'm sure probably true for many people here, you know, that they are radically contingent. In other words, the doctrine of creation isn't about how the world got started and all that stuff. It's about the fact it didn't need to exist. It is purely gratuitous. It's an act gratuit, yes? An act of pure freedom, in that sense. Culture then dreams of a kind of freedom that would try to, or fulfillment, that would emulate those theological ideas. But as I say, it doesn't. God and culture is a kind of category mistake, yes? Yeah. It just doesn't work. It tries to make culture what Raymond Williams calls somewhere abstract and absolute. Yeah. It doesn't really work.
Question behind. Thanks, Pete.
First, thank you very much for the lecture and for the beautiful rendition. I was struck, of course, by the image of the phallus of power behind the diaphanous robe of the sublime. It made me think about Wagner. I wanted to ask you how you diagnose our obedience to political regimes now that seem so bereft of the sublime.
Yes, that's very interesting. I knew that was the only bit you remember, you see. It's a very important point. Well, the sublime, of course, is terrifying. That's one way in which it resembles, to go back to the previous point, it resembles God. God is terrifying, not because he's a patriarch, because he's a terrorist of love, because God's love is utterly ruthless and uncompromising and will burn you to little bits if you're not careful. Yeah. If you don't have a sufficiently developed cultural concept of sublimity to daunt and subjugate, you're going to have to resort more and more to the naked power of the state. Yes, the state is sublime, but in a bad sublimity. Yes, because inevitably it has to put that power fully on show. And that's not good for civilization. It's not good that its underpinning terror should be too visible. That's why you need the diaphanous garments and so on. Yeah. So I think, put another way, you can subjugate people less and less by ideological or cultural means. It has to be more and more nakedly political, and that's sort of dangerous.
Okay, so we've got a couple in this area here. So, Pete, if you come forward a little bit on about the fourth row.
Hi, thank you so much. I was wondering if there's any way that we can be anti-colonialist without being nationalist, because you talked about revolutionary nationalism, yeah. And it has its immense success, but also has a lot of problems.
Yes, yes. It's a good question. I mean, I said, if you remember, that the United Irish movement was anti-colonialist, but it wasn't nationalist. Yeah. I mean, it thought in international terms. Well, even, of course, nationalism thinks very often in international terms. It's an old cliche that there are few things more international than nationalism. But it also thinks in more parochial and self-enclosed terms very often. In that, it's not the only form of anti-colonialism historically, not the only form around. You don't need to adopt a nationalist ideology, in other words, to identify and oppose a colonial power. Marxism, for example, has no truck with romantic nationalism, but certainly is anti-colonialist. You know, but thinks it through in rather different, more universalist, for example, terms. So there is an important distinction there. But the power of romantic nationalism is, of course, enormous and not in the least to be underestimated. Indeed, becomes more and more powerful and aggressive as the 19th century moves on.
There's a question there, just Pete, in the middle here, but before we come to it, can I just see if there's anyone in the balcony who does want to ask a question before I send Pete on a wild goose chase? Are there any hands up there? Okay, there is one up there, so we'll see whether that's worth going up for. In the meantime.
Thank you so much. I was wondering if you thought there were benefits in drawing a distinction between a high culture and a low culture.
Yeah, well, yes, although those terms already stack the argument somewhat. You could, for example, there are all kinds of terms. You could call it minority and popular, maybe. Yeah. Let me just say this as far as that goes. Whatever you call them, the mistake is to think that the axis of high and popular culture is coextensive with the axis good and bad. Those two axes cut across each other. Yeah. What's the most, you know, successful art form of the 20th century film? You know, which includes all kinds of, it's really popular, but all kinds of magnificent artistic achievements. So I think that one has to get away from that kind of thinking without, of course, for a moment, relinquishing the idea of evaluation. There's a kind of fashionable postmodernist notion that to evaluate is to be elitist. Yeah. But that notion is itself elitist because everybody, ordinary people, evaluate all the time. You know, it may not be between, you know, Dryden and Pope or something. You evaluate. Evaluation is a part of social existence. So in some kind of access of Puritan self-denial, to imagine that you can't act, you shouldn't evaluate. Why shouldn't you evaluate? Because to say that something is terrible, as many things in life are, let me assure those people who are still young and haven't yet, is what does it do? It commits the crime of excluding them. You know, to say that somebody's views are plain wrong, vicious, evil, is to exclude them. And we don't want them to feel excluded. Their feelings will be hurt by that. So you want to include them and pretend that their views aren't as nasty as they actually are.
So I think Pete has ascended to the gallery. The first question was sort of in that direction. Okay, there's two there now. So I'm sorry, you're going to... Okay, while he navigates the box pews, Terry, one particularly insidious phrase in the culture wars is cultural Marxism, which is what people on the right accuse the left of kind of possessing, which is to say that even though generally the right possesses political power, all the actual power is in the hands of some kind of version of a liberal media elite establishment because of a kind of universal cultural Marxism. Yeah. I'm wondering what that, how you'd critique that kind of mischaracterization of cultural power in the context of...
I don't think you should take it seriously enough to criticize it. I mean, it's simply a piece of illiteracy. Yeah. Marxism there is just a swear word. Yeah. And, you know, attacking cultural... what is cultural Marxism? Yeah. I mean, there is the Marxist critiques of culture, but that's not what they're talking about. I don't think it deserves the dignity of a response from somebody... somebody with grey hair.
Just to get Pete to ask
myself.
So much the better.
All right, he's just...
Balcony people, it's your moment.
Hi, thank you. You've talked a lot about where culture comes from and the history. Where does it go next? Or what can be done about...
Well, I think the two main... There are many meanings of culture, of course. But the two main meanings I was looking at, namely artistic and, let's say, anthropological, you know, culture as a distinctive way of life, are both in a lot of trouble. Cultural artistic because of the, well, as I was saying before, partly because of the surrender of judgment and evaluation to the commodity form. You know, what it's the commodity form which refuses to evaluate, which dead levels, which equalizes, which makes all exchanges abstract and equal. And that kind of logic, previously confined to, say, the marketplace, has increasingly penetrated the realm of culture itself. As for culture as, you know, a particular way of life, well, first of all, one of the mistakes of that tradition was always to think that particular ways of life are intrinsically valuable. But they're not, of course. There are all kinds of ways of life, collective ways of life, that aren't in the least valuable and should, you know, be done away with as soon as possible. Yeah. The Tory party, for example. it's again, there's nothing ipso facto positive about a distinctive way of life. So culture in that sense is in trouble as well, I think.
Thank you. Early in your talk, you drew, as I understood it, a difference between culture and ideology. There are some thinkers who I think would describe ideology as quite all-encompassing, that everything is produced within ideology and with some ideology attached to it. Hmm. How do you see those theories, and are there examples of non-ideological culture?
Yeah, I think the definition of ideology you've just given is a rather useless one. It's actually Althusserian. It makes ideology coextensive with experience. Yeah, lived experience, le vécu. Well, that's a very depoliticized notion of ideology which lacks a cutting edge. You know, that I would want to see ideology as more of a functional term. Certain kinds of experiences or institutions can behave ideologically in certain conditions, and or they don't. You know, I mean, ideology is a relational term, looking at a phenomenon in terms of its context. What does it do, say, to reinforce power here? But the same element that reinforces power in one context may be quite innocuous politically in another. You know, maybe the weather forecasts could be deeply ideological in some sense, you know. Maybe American weather forecasts refuse to talk about the weather other than in, you know, Texas or something like that. But that doesn't mean to say that you can't use the same thing in a different context, non-ideologically. I think culture is a much broader term than ideology. They shouldn't be conflated.
I'm just going to move to the other side of you to see if there's anyone on this side of the balcony. There is! And you've got the mic already, even better.
Do you think we'll see the return this century of religion and theological language to a more kind of conscious position within culture?
I missed the first part. What
you
said.
Do you think we'll see this?
We'll see, this, yeah. Well, a lot of elderly, grey-haired leftists seem to be turning more to theology, don't they? Possibly as a desperate tactic. I suppose there are certain situations, I think, in which theology provides a language of critique which isn't being provided elsewhere. And there are other situations in which that's not so. And I think perhaps there are certain secular left thinkers who have become to realize that, yes, that it can provide a certain kind of critique in a civilization that's greatly in need of it. But to do that, you need a massive demystification job on theology as such, I think.
We're going to take one more balcony question, then one more from the floor, and that'll be it. So,
thanks. Hi, thanks for the talk. You started by saying culture is labour, and then located the kind of commodity form within culture. So I was thinking about that dialect between freedom and capitalism, and what you think right now might be subversive culturally within capitalism.
Yeah, I didn't actually say that culture is labour. I said that labour is a source of culture. It's a very kind of wide statement. And frequently doesn't recognise itself to be such. As for subversion and culture, I mean, I think culture has to be put back in its place, if you like, as a more modest concept than it's now become. It's become, of course, a terrible buzzword, you know. But it's part of a materialist belief, I suppose, that culture isn't where it's at. Yeah, that's a fundamental disagreement between spontaneously idealist cultural thinkers and, let's say, cultural thinkers of the left. Cultural thinkers of the left are, or should be, aware that culture isn't where it's at, and that it too often has tried to serve that role. It too often has tried, it's been too often a massive displacement of what are properly economic or political or material issues into this special realm. You know, that's not, of course, to say that culture isn't, you know, a vital notion, but it shouldn't be allowed to get out of hand. And as far as its subversiveness or otherwise goes, I mean, I think that all depends on the political context. Culture can't legislate, political transformation into being. That was one realization of the great revolutionary avant-gardes of the early 20th century, you know, that the crisis was essentially a political one and not a cultural one. And culture had to follow suit, so to speak. So there are situations, as in Weimar and Bolshevik Russia, where culture becomes enormously forceful and potent as a critique, but only because anterior political conditions exist for that to happen.
I feel like I neglected these two aisles, so we'll take the last question from here. Final hand, is that one on the edge? The back corner.
Hello, thank you again. Just maybe a simple question to answer. What's your evaluative framework for deciding whether something cultural is good or bad?
Let's say that you were witnessing some form of culture in a very different society, yes? Let's say you were sitting through a piece of, I don't know, medieval Japanese drama. I don't even know if there is any medieval Japanese drama, but let's say, you know. What kind of things could you say about it at the end? You could say whether it was boring or vivid or fast-moving or in some way powerful. What you couldn't say is whether it was good or bad, could you? Why not? Because you wouldn't have access to the cultural criteria which determined what counted as good or bad in that context, yes? So with culture, as with moral discourse in general, you have to have access to certain criteria which you can always question, to be sure, but which here and now determine what counts as goodness or badness in that context. He's been deeply skeptical of that, but anyway.
Okay, a final question then, Terry. Why do you sing?
Why do I sing?
Why do you sing?
Because like a lot of academics, I'm a lecturer, I'm an actor manqué. I really had wanted to be an entertainer, you know. I come from a family of failed entertainers. I suppose I've tried to keep that going.
Thank you very much. Terry Eagleton.
Terry Eagleton, speaking at St James's Church, Clerkenwell, on the 27th of March. And you can watch all the LRB winter lectures from this and previous years on our YouTube channel. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt.